And welcome back, Blogging Heads viewers, to another episode of Foreign Entanglements, where we talk about pressing international affairs issues of the day. Today, I'm pleased to introduce my guest, Dr. Anna Poles. She's currently Senior Lecturer in Security Studies at Massey University in Wellington, New Zealand. Anna, welcome.
Thank you very much, Natalie.
Anna, you've got a very strong interest in many security areas, among them including the Pacific Islands, peace and conflict studies, peacekeeping, and gender. I'd like you to just introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them a little bit about yourself and your interest in security studies.
Okay, thank you. Starting with my interest really stemmed from the fact that I grew up in Asia and the Pacific as a consequence of parents in the New Zealand diplomatic service. So international relations was always very much part of my childhood and really informed and influenced my interest as I went into university. And I always knew I wanted to work in this region, and I was particularly concerned about why things were happening and the need to ensure that different voices and perspectives are represented beyond the norm and the conventional thinking around issues. So I came from that perspective of having grown up in a region where, when I arrived at university to do my undergraduate degree and later a PhD in Canberra, ANU, I found that the different voices from the region weren't actually represented in a lot of the readings and so forth that I was given. And I was acutely aware of this, and this really drove me to focus much of my work from my master's onwards very much on looking at different perspectives and bringing those different perspectives forward to the more sort of conventional debates around peacekeeping, stabilisation, peace and conflict and so forth.
Sure. And I suppose for Australians like myself and yourself and for Kiwis, it's quite common for us to think of the region. Just for our mostly American audience, what do we define as our region?
Well, I think that probably depends where you're sitting, actually. So our region, well, from our perspective down here, would very much be the Pacific, but that is, you know, an enormous, expansive place, and within that, it's important to recognize that it's by no means homogenous. It's very different depending on where you're sitting in the Pacific. If it might be in Samoa or Papua New Guinea or in the Northern Pacific.
And you did I was just going to say, you did your doctoral research on Solomon Islands, is that right?
I did my PhD on the relationship and the dynamics between peacekeepers and local populations in Timor and the Solomons. And my particular interest, again, was looking at how you can gauge mission success and mission legitimacy and sustainable peace through that critical relationship between local populations and peacekeepers. So much of the focus is always on the elite, the national elite, and so forth. But ultimately, it's that local population at the village level, grassroots level, who will determine the sustainability of that peace.
And I'd like to return to peacekeeping actually in the Pacific as well, but just to broaden it out a little bit, since we're talking about countries in the Pacific areas, we're talking about Papua New Guinea, Solomons, Timor, so on and so forth, I would just like to give our audience an idea of actually why this particular region is of greater strategic interest and greater international affairs interest. You've seen a lot of Chinese money come down into the region in the form of developer assistance and loans and so forth. What's the potential there for strategic competition, and how significant is this part of the world?
Well, I'm pretty biased, but I think this part of the world is actually fairly significant from a geopolitical and geostrategic perspective. There's no doubt that, and particularly in two theatres in the Pacific, Western Pacific and the South Pacific, that there's growing geostrategic competition. And this is about two things. It's about influence and it's about resource security. And particularly both fisheries security, fish stocks, and deep sea mineral mining, which is going to be the next big thing. And without a doubt, we're seeing increased interest in both of those. There's strong competition around resource security, and there's going to be growing competition around deep sea mineral mining. Now, this has geopolitical ramifications, obviously, because we've already seen. The Pacific has always been contested by different, what I refer to as periphery powers like China, Russia, the US, And Japan, Taiwan, the Korea, and other deep water fishing nations, also European fishing nations like Spain and others. So the Pacific has always been contested by these periphery, by these external powers, but that contest is, in my view, is that competition is going to increase as fish stocks run low, as there's a need to find other sources of energy and so forth, minerals and this is simply going to keep increasing. I mean, we're looking at, for example, in the Western Pacific in 2048, where the fish stocks are predicted to be depleted. There is increasing talk around by the deep water fishing nations for the need for vessels to be provided with military escorts as competition increases and so forth. And then there's the other aspect too. There's the fact that, for example, from a Chinese perspective, the Western Pacific, the islands of the Western Pacific, which include the American Pacific regions around federated sites of Micronesia, Palau, Guam, etc., they fall into what's referred to in the Chinese military lexicon as the second island chain, mm-hmm. Which is part of the 1980s of Admiral Liu's projection, his naval strategy, where China would control the first, second, and third island chains by 2040. And so you're going to see increased interest in claiming geostrategic influence over these regions, particularly as there's a stronger push towards maritime power. And Russia has also demonstrated that it is increasingly testing the waters in the region as well, both in the air by its frequent incursions into American airspace over Guam, and also by its redeployment of submarines into the Pacific Ocean. So again, we see this increasing contest over influence and control of access as well, which is very important.
So, I mean, some of that competition is obviously between the periphery powers themselves. Mm. Can you speak to perhaps the capabilities of countries in the region to be able to resist or to deal with that kind of strategic competition? And is there a role for countries like Australia and New Zealand?
Absolutely. I mean, there's absolutely a role because it's imperative that the resources and that the stability of the Pacific Island countries are not impacted by the strategic competition. And obviously they have been in the past and they will be in the future. Mm-hmm. But when you have states which are already struggling as a consequence of internal factors, whether it be corruption or the impact of climate change and El Nino, and that's only going to worsen in the Pacific over the coming years, unemployment, all those other factors which create stresses on a country, particularly on a country which does not have a large budget to respond to those stresses, it's inevitable that they can become caught up in these geopolitical games by the larger powers. In my view, Australia and New Zealand have a direct responsibility to actually ensure that these countries are not unfairly taken advantage of. And that's not to suggest that that Pacific Island countries don't have agency, because they do, and very capable of navigating these waters. But as we know, the power imbalances are such that sometimes it's not easy. And New Zealand and Australia have been guilty of that as well. I mean, one only has to consider the offshore detention centres that Australia runs to acknowledge the fact that both Australia and New Zealand do use the power imbalance to their favour. And that's one of the debates around the future of the Pacific Islands Forum.
Sure.
Certainly. So I would like to see both Australia and New Zealand taking a very, very proactive role around climate change, around deep sea mineral mining, around resource protection, and both countries are very, very engaged in this issue because we have a vested interest in this part of the world.
Actually, I was going to ask a provocative question. I mean, are we living up to that responsibility? You suggest at the end we do, but I mean, to what extent do you think that's satisfactory?
Well, certainly in regards to climate change, there is strong criticism throughout the region that Australia and New Zealand are not actually living up to their obligations and their commitments. So I think, yes, to a degree, but both countries could do much more, actually, to listen to what Pacific Island countries want, to what their needs and priorities are, rather than the classic, dare I say, neocolonialistic approach that both countries have taken towards the region. It's very much about time to move aside and support Pacific Island countries to be in the driver's seat of the region, of what happens to their countries, because ultimately it impacts them and their populations much more so than it does for Australia and New Zealand.
Fair enough. I mean, looking at other kinds of areas where Australia has taken up its responsibility and New Zealand as well, I would just like to talk a little bit about the case of East Timor. And so for our listeners, if you can just give them a quick shakedown of the events surrounding 1999 and the UN-led peacekeeping mission there, and then I'd like for us to talk a little bit about what we learned from that experience.
Okay, well, very briefly, as your listeners will be aware, in 1975, Indonesia invaded Timor, and in 1999, the Indonesian government agreed to a UN-sponsored referendum on whether Timor would remain with Indonesia or pursue independence. And Australia and New Zealand played a really critical role at that time to support that process. Australia particularly led INTERFET, the international force that went into Timor, following the referendum. And the UN obviously played a critical role enabling that referendum to take place. So both countries, both Australia and New Zealand, have been very much engaged in Timor since 1999 particularly, but certainly but also beforehand as well. But in terms of supporting Timorese independence, both countries have been very much of a view that this is a responsibility, perhaps to right some wrongs, actually, having not done anything previous to 1999, given relations with Indonesia. So there are some important lessons that come out of the Timor experience for both Australia and New Zealand, and also for other countries that were involved. It was a multinational UN force that ultimately went in, and certainly in 2006. And there are some significant lessons around, and probably the most important ones, around actually both in terms of understanding the context that you're going to, but ensuring that there's local buy-in, local ownership of the processes that take place. And this is particularly relevant to 2006, but even going back to 1999 and the establishment of UNTAET and the successive UN missions, state-building missions that were established following the referendum for independence. And again, one of the things that we found out in those early years and in the 2000s was the fact that it was very much UN-driven, and there's been considerable criticism about the fact that the UN mission did not sufficiently engage with the local population in terms of particularly capacity building. And this, when Australia and New Zealand went into the Solomon Islands with RAMSI, the Regional Assistance Mission to the Solomon Islands, in 2003, many of those issues were at the forefront of people's minds in Canberra and Wellington, of not replicating that, of ensuring that there was much more emphasis on capacity building of local skills to prevent what happened in many cases in Timor, where you had ministries where 75% of bureaucrats were UN officials.
You spent a lot of time in Timor, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
You did, actually.
I was there for 8 years.
For the time that you spent there and the people that you spoke to, what were their impressions of the Australian and New Zealand commitment to peacekeeping and the UN mission there?
That's a really good question, because it changed over time. When I arrived in 2006, when the crisis occurred and I was...
So just to recap, there was another crisis in 2006.
Yes. So in 1999, the tension was between the Timorese and the Indonesians and the departing Indonesian forces and militias. 2006 occurred, and what happened, as so often happens in these contexts, all the local tensions and dynamics that had been frozen by a period of intervention, or in this case, occupation, 24 years of occupation, all those local dynamics and political competition and tensions arose after independence. And they date back to 1974 and earlier, the power struggles that were going on internally within Timor. So this emerged in 2006. And so the Australian-led International Stabilisation Force came back into Timor. Interestingly enough, about 4 days before the crisis happened, the UN was actually packing up shop. And they were saying, yeah, Timor was a success. Timor was the poster child of international state building. It was one of the first new states in the new century. And therefore, everything was a success. And yet, for years, probably since around 2003, 2004, trouble had been brewing. And in 2006, it exploded again and was extremely difficult time with tensions between military and the police. There was identity politics used to the very worst, where you had people from the east and west in conflict with each other and pushing Easterners out of the capital and so forth. So it was, so again, Australia and New Zealand came back in, and I arrived at this point to work with the Timorese government, and it was very clear to me at those early days that the perception of Australia and New Zealand was very much of being a friend, of coming back in to support Timor because of what they had done in 99 and supporting Timor towards independence. What happened, unfortunately, was Australia and New Zealand, because they mismanaged a lot of that early entry into Timor in 2006. They didn't necessarily understand the dynamics were very different, and that it was actually far more complex in many ways because they were dealing with very different factions. It wasn't a homogenous sort of Timorese group that they were dealing with. And during those early days in 2006, the Australians did a number of things which actually impacted their local perceptions of Timorese, of Australians, sorry. And they also fell victim to the Portuguese doing some destabilizing, to shifting perceptions around Australians. And so there was a very strong sort of anti-Australian propaganda being pushed by the Portuguese during that time, which could have probably been handled a bit better by the Australians, actually.
By the Portuguese, so, wow.
Yes. So that was a very sort of, there was a power struggle going on as well during 2006. This did impact the way Australians and New Zealanders were perceived. And there was also, and this is inevitable too, when you've had a country which has experienced so much international intervention, they've experienced years of the UN being there, and everything that means in terms of the, you know, dual economies, the cost of living being pushed up, access to housing, food costs being pushed up, all those kind of impacts, as well as the positives, you know, the employment and so forth too. But it impacted, people become tired and they become weary and a little bit more critical. And it's that critical point, that critical period where where interveners need to be much more engaged with local populations. And what happened particularly in 2006 was that the UN and the international forces were not necessarily going outside Dili. They weren't going outside the capital. They weren't necessarily going outside the large towns. And 80% of Timor's population lives in the rural areas. And so people didn't really know. The interveners weren't necessarily engaging with the local populations, and vice versa. And that impacted on people's perceptions as well.
That's an interesting question. Now, was that because of political reasons? Was that due to force protection reasons? Was that due to just lack of planning or lack of awareness? What do you think?
I think it was a combination of all those factors, actually. Force protection, certainly from a UN perspective, during a period where there was violence outside of Dili, there was a reluctance to, where people were prevented from travelling out, usual restrictions, UN restrictions on that. Certainly, you know, but there were areas where both the Australians, New Zealanders, Portuguese, Malaysians, and other contingents were located. But it was This probably could have been done much more. There could be much more focus on that degree of engagement, and even community engagement in Delhi itself could have been handled much better. And this is where probably the difference between New Zealand and Australia was most significant. And I think this is as a consequence, and this is my view, as a consequence of Australian deployments. Excuse me, between 1999 and 2006, experiences in Iraq and elsewhere, force protection increased significantly. And there were numerous times where the degrees of force protection actually impacted on the ability of the forces to protect civilians. And so this also impacted on perceptions of legitimacy and credibility on the part of the local population. There were numerous issues around the slow speed with which the UN deployed in 2006. For example, we didn't have the full police contingent for a good 6 months. And there were logistical problems as a consequence of that. Mm-hmm. So you had, I remember one occasion particularly where we ran into an ambush and in the capital, and a Australian federal police officer drove past but was unable to stop because he was on his own, and he didn't have the logistics had been so slow, and so he was unable to actually stop. And this happened repeatedly, where warehouses with rice were being burnt, or houses were being burnt, but there was a lack of clarity around, certainly from the local population's perspective, around what the Australian New Zealand mandate was, and also force protection issues as well, which prevented the Australia and New Zealand being able to engage where perhaps they should. There were also examples of where they did engage and went above and beyond too. So I think that's important to note too.
I think it's probably a good point to actually raise the co-edited volume that you've been involved with. Anna, you've been co-editor for this book called The United Nations Peacekeeping Challenge, The Importance of the Integrated Approach. It's published currently by Ashgate. And it's got some very interesting chapters and sections in there which talk about the range of peacekeeping, not only from the intervening country's perspective, but also from the peacekeeping forces' perspective. You were talking just now about force protection and protection of civilians and so on and so forth. In the book, could we talk a little bit about what we've learned and where we've done that better in global peacekeeping operations?
Where we've done force protection, protection civilians better.
I mean, have we learnt from Timor, specifically that the Timorese case, since then, what does the scorecard look like so far?
Well, I think, I don't think you can compare Timor perhaps to examples in Africa, and South Sudan, and other examples where there has been such enormous human tragedy. Certainly can't compare to Timor in 2006 to that. But I think there are some significant lessons, certainly around the need for technology to support missions to be able to actually protect civilians. One of the areas that Amira Haque, the former Undersecretary General for Field Operations, talks about in her chapter in the book is the need for better technology, better access to assets like helicopters, the use of UAVs, for instance, to provide both better protection for peacekeepers as they're increasingly targeted, but also protection of civilians as well. And that means, and this has come out in the review and debates around peacekeeping that have occurred over the past 6 months. And we saw the school board up at the UN as countries committed different things, different assets or money or units and so forth to peacekeeping. We saw there's recognition that troop contributing countries need better support, assets, logistics, financial support, resources, personnel. Whether or not countries actually front up and provide those, meet those commitments that they've made, I think only time will tell. But there's no doubt about it. You're asking people to go into often horrific situations with very little support. We saw this in Timor And we see that on a grander scale in countries in Africa, South Sudan, elsewhere, where the support simply hasn't been given. And you know, the classic example of this is Rwanda in 1994. And Romeo Dallaire wrote about this in his book, Shake Hands with the Devil. And the question is, you know, have we learned anything from 1994 in Rwanda in terms of what peacekeepers need to actually do the job and prevent prevent the tragedies that have and genocides that have occurred? And the answer to that, I think, is we may understand the lesson intellectually, but whether or not we're actually willing to put our money where our mouths are is another question. And
fair enough. I mean, it's an interesting this question of are we providing them with enough? Because of course, your book deals with an issue, an area that hasn't been dealt with very much, which is the duty of care to peacekeepers. Yeah. Why is it that you decided to include this particular area, duty of care to peacekeepers serving and those who are exposed to tragedy?
We included this. The book actually, the origins of the book was the Pacific Army Chiefs and Army Management seminar in 2013. It was held in Auckland. It was a joint US Army, New Zealand Army conference. And for the first time, duty of care was actually put on the table to be discussed. And this was very much as a result of the New Zealand Army pushing this as an issue that we need to talk about. Because it's not just peacekeepers, it's soldiers. I mean, we see the enormous tragedy with returning soldiers and veterans in the US, which has been highly publicized. And we felt very strongly that it was a critical issue that needs to be talked about, needs to be discussed. And often it's very hard for peacekeepers and soldiers and those involved in these situations to be able to come forward. So we very much felt it was a responsibility to include this work and to talk about the great work that's been done by academics, by practitioners around this issue. We were fortunate to have a chapter by the Australian General John Cantwell talking about his very personal experiences dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. And there's a number of other chapters there which deal with this issue and look at how it's being dealt with in Australia, New Zealand, the US and elsewhere. Without doubt, you know, and this is a question which comes up all the time. We expect a great deal of these men and women, and I include, you know, not just those in uniform, but also others, also civilians who are in these situations too. You know, we expect a great deal from them, but don't necessarily give them the kind of support that people need when you come back from working in countries like this, where they bear witness to, you know, some of the worst tragedies of that we've seen in modern times, and for that reason, we need to actually give them the support and understand and appreciate the psychological and impact that this kind of work, this very important work, actually has on men and women.
I mean, the Australian military is starting to recognise that more and more. What is the case over in New Zealand right now with regards to providing adequate care after conflict?
Well, it's more certainly being done, but it's still a slow road. There's a lot of sort of institutional cultural reasons why this is slow to deal with. Without a doubt, the conversation is happening, and that in itself is a breakthrough. But certainly, my colleagues and the contributors who write about New Zealand in this book are very conscious in the work that they're doing that more still needs to be done to recognise early signs, to deal with the issues, to ensure that soldiers, that young women and men are not being sent back into theatres when they're showing the early signs. That more needs to be done when people return. We're slowly getting there, but still a lot does need to be done to provide the support to the families as well.
Sure. I mean, one of the reasons I bring this up is that New Zealand is obviously one of the countries that are providing troops and advisors to the commitment against ISIS, Islamic State, whatever you want to call it, in Iraq at the moment. And I know that you had written on the Lowy Institute's blog, The Interpreter, talking about a lack of clarity, a lack of mission, a lack of status for these forces. Let's just explore that a little bit. So if we are sending Kiwi troops back, and obviously Australia is sending troops at the moment as advisors as well, can you talk a little bit about what New Zealand's commitment is there right now?
Well, it's similar to Australia's commitment in relation to the building partner capacity program. And so non-combat, obviously, and working with the Australians and with other countries to build the capacity of the Iraqi security forces. Now, the New Zealand Prime Minister John Key has given us sort of a two-year window on that commitment. I think it raises, in my view, it raises a lot of questions. I mean, it's probably the least contribution, the smallest contribution that New Zealand could possibly make, whilst making a contribution at the same stretch. How effective that's going to be. My questions have been around the question of effectiveness, of security sector development, of training. How do you measure effectiveness? How do you judge it? How do you ensure that your training is sustainable? And none of this occurs in a vacuum, as you know. The security sector reform and any kind of training of security forces doesn't occur in a vacuum. And there's been an enormous amount of literature and reports around why it never hasn't worked so far in Iraq, why the US haven't worked, why their efforts have not worked. The emphasis, the New Zealand niche has been very much around, well, this is all about local ownership and local partnership, and that's absolutely commendable. But that takes longer than 2 years, and is New Zealand willing to commit to longer than 2 years? Is the New Zealand electorate willing to commit? And is there going to be any kind of mission creep? And that's what everybody is concerned about, is that that there will be that inevitable mission creep.
Actually, that was going to be one of my questions. I mean, you know, when countries are going into places like Iraq, they don't often think, well, I mean, you know, if I'm looking just from the perspective of the United States, looking for coalition partners, I think it would be good for us to know what the public opinion is in New Zealand. What was public opinion like at the time that John Key announced that New Zealand would be sending troops?
There was a strong resistance to this.
And why? Why was that?
Concerns over what New Zealand would actually be doing, what the troops would be being asked to do, whether or not New Zealand should be involved in this, the fact that lessons from previous interventions hadn't necessarily been heeded, and things didn't really. New Zealand had been opposed was never part of the original sort of coalition into Iraq. In fact, it's, you know, publicly been referred to as an invasion. So there was a strong sense of, well, what are we doing there? How are we going to contribute? How are we going to make a difference? Is this even the best approach? Can New Zealand afford to be doing this? So there was a lot of questions around this, around whether or not New Zealand should actually even be there. And there were others, of course. There was on the other side of the debate was, well, we need to do something. We don't have a large defence force, so what can we do? And New Zealand is very good at engaging with militaries of different backgrounds, whether that be ethnic, religious, or so forth. And New Zealand does have a reputation for being very good at that personal degree of engagement, and very good at training too. But ultimately, you know, is it going to be enough? And that's, I think, what everybody is asking. Is this actually enough? How does this actually contribute to the ultimate goals? And should we be focusing our efforts much more on post-conflict reconstruction, et cetera, et cetera?
And just looking at the world from New Zealand's perspective for a second, I mean, one of the things I wanted to do with this series was to highlight security issues from the perspective of our part of the world. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to end on your opinion and say, well, what sort of security issues, sitting in Wellington, looking at the globe, should we really be thinking about?
Well, it's a big sweep, actually.
It is a big sweep, but sometimes we need to look at global security issues and international affairs issues from another part of the globe, and I think, you know, this is a chance for us to do that.
I agree. And I think that, I mean, there are some of the big ones. I mean, obviously, I mean, New Zealand has always been very, very engaged internationally over debates around norms and so forth. So, and I think New Zealand will certainly continue to be so. And with a seat on the Security Council, it's very much an opportunity to try to influence and to ensure that we keep pushing on issues like Syria, Middle East, those are very critical issues, which may not affect us directly, but as, you know, responsible global citizens, as New Zealanders like to think of themselves, then it certainly does. More acutely, though, the issues around climate change, we have to think about that, because that will have security implications, right from, you know, climate-proofing New Zealand Defence Force through to climate-related conflict or, you know, people migration, et cetera, et cetera. We need to think about that. The degree of geopolitical competition that's occurring between China, Russia, the US, the other big players, that will increasingly encroach on our region as a consequence of what we talked about before in terms of access to resources. You know, what's going to happen over Antarctica? 2048, the Antarctic Treaty is up for review. There's, you know, as technology advances, countries are more and more interested about mining and accessing resources in Antarctica. That's obviously right here in Australia, New Zealand's area of responsibility and interest. So I think, you know, climate change is obviously one that we need to do a lot around, because there are direct security implications, and it's but also can keep sort of contributing to the debates around how we do peacekeeping better, and to keep pushing in those areas, I think is very much a part of what, you know, both New Zealand and Australia can do over, you know, human rights, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's those are the areas where we can keep waving the flag and trying to have some kind of impact. But from our perspective, and, you know, this part of the world, most definitely resource security, climate change, the geopolitical and geostrategic competitions that are going to occur as a consequence of that in the coming decades.
Sure. And I'm sure you and I are both waiting to see what happens at COP21 in Paris later this month.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Mm. And to all our viewers, if you want to read a little bit more about the implications of peacekeeping and what we've learnt, don't forget the new volume that was co-edited by Anna, United Nations Peacekeeping Challenge, The Importance of the Integrated Approach, published currently by Ashgate. Anna, I just want to thank you very much for sharing your knowledge and your time.
Thanks very much, Nat.
No worries. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye.